This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
Featuring defense attorney, Hidden Killers daily contributor, and host of the Defense Diaries podcast, Bob Motta.
So we've had a little bit of time to take a look at the 36-page filing the other week, the Odinistic stories. Fantastical, very interesting. If there's legitimacy to it, would make it even more amazing. What's your thoughts now that you've had some time to digest it?
Yeah, it's all those things, all those adjectives that you just used. It's definitely that. I have a couple thoughts on it.
Yeah.
First and foremost, I think that there's no question that this was the defense taking the opportunity to get their theory of the case out to the public. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, like, you know, because ultimately at the core of what that memo is supposed to be mm-hmm. is the fact that they're asking for this Franks hearing,
yeah.
right? Which I think we talked a little bit about last week.
Yes.
And again, you know, Franks hearing, and in case you didn't hear last week's episode or you need a quick refresher, it's essentially where you're attacking a warrant and saying that law enforcement intentionally and or recklessly lied and or omitted information in order to secure a search warrant. Mm-hmm. All right. And it can't just be bald assertions by the defense. They have to come in with some receipts, which they do. You know, I mean, they're going to have Liggett in his affidavit and the language he had in there, but they have the police reports, and I'm assuming that they will have both of these witnesses testify mm-hmm. as to what they actually said, and they'll have them verify, okay, well, here's the police report from the statement that you gave on such and such a date, and is this accurate as to what you told that officer? And if they confirm that, then it's going to confirm the fact that Tony Liggett came in front of a judge and lied. So now that doesn't necessarily mean that the warrant is going to be suppressed, or essentially what happens is the warrant's quashed and then the evidence is suppressed. So it's two things happen. Mm-hmm. So, but if Judge Gull finds that in fact Liggett did lie as to those two things, and the judge then says, okay, well, I'm going to remove those from the warrant or the application for the warrant mm-hmm. and the affidavit, do I still find that even if I take those two things out, that there's enough probable cause for this warrant to have been issued? And if she finds the answer to that question to be yes, which it's in her discretion, mm-hmm. right? It's like that's a strictly the judge's discretion. She is the one who is going to decide, yeah, you know, I think that there's enough, or no, I don't think there's enough. If she finds that there's not enough, then the motion's going to get granted and they're going to suppress everything that they found in the house. And remember, this isn't an attack on the arrest. Like, we all have read the PCA for the arrest.
Yeah.
Like, that was kind of the famous PCA.
Sure.
What this is the attack on the search of Richard Allen's house, which, interestingly, they used what they recovered in that house in the affidavit for warrant for the arrest. So theoretically, if she were to grant this motion and it takes out the 40 caliber weapon, takes out the clothes that they recovered, the various knives, mm-hmm. and they have to pull all of that from the probable cause affidavit for the arrest, it's like there's going to be attack on that as well.
Yeah.
Because then it's the same question. It's a different scenario, but it's the scenario where, okay, now we're looking at an arrest warrant and you still have to have the probable cause for the arrest. If you take all of that out, is there enough for the arrest warrant to stand? So I foresee that if it's granted, that she will definitely be getting a motion from the defense where they're attacking and seeking to quash the arrest warrant. So that brings me back to the bigger point
yeah.
about, you know, that language is buried. And I don't think it starts until 105, where they actually get into the legal argument about what that particular memo is supposed to be about. So when you look at that, and you look at there's 105 pages that precede it, and where they get into all of these fantastical concepts of, you know, it was a ritualistic scene,
yeah.
and they give us a history on what Odinism is. And, you know, they then bring up a bunch of people that they've found that are connected to Abby and Libby potentially, that all practice this in some fashion. Mm-hmm. You know, they go to the lengths of saying, look, we believe that these are people that have hijacked, that are white supremacists, that have hijacked this, you know, religion or this belief, and have used that in terms of the way that the killings took place. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the problem with that document is, like, from a defense attorney's perspective, I understand why they did it, because typically the only narrative that comes out at the beginning of a case is, of course, the prosecution's, and it's in that PCA.
Sure.
And most of the time, in most cases, say, for instance, in Idaho 4.
Yeah.
Like, we've heard nothing from the defense. So the only story that's out there and will be out there up until trial is the story that the state has put forward in its PCA. Mm-hmm. So this is an unusual circumstance where the defense has been able to get their narrative out, which we can anticipate would be what they were going to be presenting at trial as his defense. And that is now out there for public consumption. And you can see it if you get online.
Yeah.
That it was a very effective technique. There's people that are like, this thing was outrageous. It's garbage. It's just them pushing a narrative and they have no substance behind it. And then you have a huge portion of society saying, wow, there's something here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So it's goal achieved. Now, the problem is that you're going to have a judge that is going to be furious.
Okay.
That they filed that not under seal.
Yeah.
Because within 2.5 hours of the thing getting dropped, and we had gotten our copy of it, which I sent you directly from the clerk. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't any, like, at the point that it was filed, it wasn't sealed. Mm-hmm. So the clerk didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the clerk was just saying, yeah, here's the filings. They're not under seal. So here you go.
Sure.
So we got them. And then within a couple hours, Gull lays her eyes on it and she says, no, seal this immediately. So, but, you know, the proverbial cat was out of the bag at that point.
Sure.
I mean, it was already out there. We had all seen it. I was already reading it into a Twitter Spaces thing. So, you know, it was like there was no putting that toothpaste back in the tube at that point. But I think ultimately, you know, when Gull is getting to the meat of the motion, which again is what I explained initially, which is that Frank's hearing thing, I think her disdain for what was in that particular thing is going to ultimately, if she's on the fence as to whether or not there's enough probable cause existing, if she strips all that stuff out, I think she'll be irritated enough to where if she's on the fence that even subconsciously she's going to find that there's enough there just because she wants this thing to proceed to trial, because it would be a massive blow.
You're consuming the Hidden Killers podcast.
Want more? Start binging on all of our true crime podcasts right now through Apple Podcasts and get an ad-free experience when you sign up to be a True Crime Today Premium Plus member, exclusively on Apple Podcasts.
More of the Hidden Killers podcast, dropping soon.
Press subscribe now.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.